Okay, so here's a question. What is a dream exactly? I mean, you know one when you have one. It's this scene or this vignette that plays out in your mind while you're sleeping. But what is it? That is, how does the body pull it off? Because it seems like we're seeing it. But of course, our eyes aren't open. We're hearing it. We're feeling it. But we're not in a conscious state. So how is our brain creating this experience of seeing and hearing and feeling? Robert Stickgold and Antonio Zadra studied dreaming. They're sleep and dream researchers. Stickgold is at Harvard. Zadra is at the University of Montreal. And they've written a book explaining the purpose of a dream. That is, what our brain is trying to accomplish by giving us one. And the best way to start thinking about this is to break it down. Think about how a child tries to make sense of a dream. Stickgold tells this story in the book about his two-year-old daughter, Jessie. And her grandpa, Irv, had come to visit.
He had brought her this little marionette duck, a wooden duck that he could get to dance around. And he had it dance on the floor, and it climbed up Jessie, and it gave her a kiss. And she loved it so much that when we put her to bed that night, she insisted that we hang the duck up on the radiator pipes going up to the ceiling so that she could see it. And about a half hour later, we're all back downstairs, except Jessie, who's asleep now. And we hear screams coming from upstairs. And I go running up there, and there's Jessie standing up in her cribs, up on her toes, her arms stretched out towards me in obvious terror. And I rush up to her, and I pick her up. And as I pick her up, she swings around in my arms and looks back and says, "There's a duck in my bed." It was her first dream report. And in looking at it later, I remember thinking, so why did her brain decide to what? Put her and the duck in the bed together? I mean, what was her brain trying to do? And it turns out that when we're dreaming, and when Jessie was dreaming, her brain was just saying, what is that about? Was that a real duck? And it's just creating these narratives, these scenarios, these little stories, trying to explore possibilities, possible ways to understand what happened by what we have stored away in our brains in terms of other information. So it just popped that real live duck in her crib.
Tony, tell us about your conversation with your nephew, Sebastian. It seems to illustrate a similar kind of thing.
Yes. When my nephew, Sebastian, was 5, he thought he had a pretty good grasp on what dreaming was. And so at one point, we had a conversation that went a little bit like this. I asked him, "Sebastian, you've already told me that you sometimes remember your dreams, right?" And he went, "Yes, that's good. And can you tell me where these dreams take place?" And he went, "Well, they're like in front of me." "In front of you how?" "They're just in front of me. I see them with my eyes." "And when you have these dreams, Sebastian, are you sleeping or awake?" And then there was a pause and he gave me a strange look. And he went, "Well, sleeping, of course." "Fine. And do you sleep with your eyes open or closed?" And then to that he said, "Closed, of course, like if I was some idiot." So then I asked him, "So if your eyes are closed during your sleep, how do you manage to see your dreams?" And it's then that he called my sister and went, "Mom, Uncle Tony's asking me those dumb questions again." And so this illustrates really that learning what dreams are, how they arise in our minds, how we perceive them and hear things while we are asleep is really quite tricky. And it takes a while before we as children realize that they're imaginary, that they're generated from inside of us, and that other people sleeping can't see our dreams like we do, that they're private, subjective experiences. All of this takes a little while to sort of sink in and absorb correctly in children. These steps that we see in children also mirrors how ancient societies and our ancestors often conceptualized dreams. And so there's just interesting parallels on how dreams in general have been viewed in the past and also how children develop their understanding about them.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about dreams today, and there are a million things we could cover. Can you interpret a dream? What is it with sex in dreams? Why do we have nightmares? Do dogs dream? What does a blind person experience with a dream? And I'll warn you, we won't get to everything, but we will try and figure out the purpose of a dream. You know, why we have them, what they are, where they come from. Robert Stickgold and Antonio Zadra's book is When Brains Dream. So if a dream is such a subjective experience, something so abstract, playing out inside a person's mind, how do you study it? You know, what's to measure? That's where we began the conversation. Robert Stickgold went first.
Dreams are hard to study scientifically because we can't measure them the way we like to measure things, with machines, with instruments, with tape measures, with thermometers. All we have is the subjective reports of the people who dream. And often I'll get this complaint that, well, you can't really study them scientifically because all you have is a subjective report. And that's really nonsense. I mean, if you think about it, we study things like depression. And people come into their doctor and they say they're depressed, and the doctor doesn't have a problem believing that. And how does he know that the patient is depressed? By a subjective report. The patient says, well, I feel this way. I can't get up. I don't have the energy to get going in the morning. I think everything's going horribly. And the doctor believes that and says, well, okay, I know what's going on because we've studied this medically and we know how to treat it medically. It's a scientific and a medical problem that we're very comfortable talking about and studying. So I don't understand why people think that dreaming should be any more difficult than that. We have subjective reports, and yes, they're subjective, but we can collect them from dozens of people or hundreds of people or even thousands of people and look at the similarities. We can monitor the sleep that they're having physiologically, and we can wake them up from different physiological states of sleep and show that they have different qualities in their dreams depending on the sleep states they are awakened from. And so there's a lot of really hardcore science you can do about it. That doesn't take away from the wonder and the mystery and the amazement that we have with our dreams. I mean, that's still there, but we can study them scientifically.
Tony, why do you think it is that people don't see a science of dreaming, that they have a hard time making that connection? Is it because dreams are so, you know, so intimate, so personal, so strange? Sometimes they're sexual. I mean, they're deeply, deeply private things.
I think that for many people, when they think about dreams, what really springs to mind is, what do dreams mean? How can they be understood or interpreted? And because there's so much uncertainty about dreams and what they mean, that they fail to see that there's a whole other set of questions, much more rigorous and scientific, people can ask about the where and why of dreams. But for many people, again, when you mention dreams, they think of Freud, they think of dream interpretation, they think of these concepts related to the unconscious and hidden desires. And so for them, their impression is that when people say they study dreams, they really study dreams through these interpretive angles, which is only a small sliver of what people can do in terms of wanting to better understand the nature and function of dreams.
One of the things you both do in the book is you take us through the history of research into dreams, or what you describe as the peaks and the troughs of the research. And I want to get to some of that here in a moment. But I'm interested when your own interest takes shape. One of the things you write about is that there was this period in the late 70s, I think, and 80s, when there was this popular view that dreams were, they're just these random firings going on in the brain. They're probably meaningless. So when did your own interest take hold in that? When did you start to really push back against that? Because that is one of the things you do in your research and in the book, that they're not meaningless, that there's something purposeful going on here.
For myself, my interest in dreams really began, and this might sound a little corny to some, but it literally began with a dream that I had that really left me really perplexed. I found out later that these kinds of dreams had a name, namely lucid dreams, or dreams in which you are aware that you are dreaming while you're experiencing it. And this led me then to this fascinating research at the time that was coming out of Stanford University, as well as the University of Hull in England, where people were able to study objectively lucid dreaming in the sleep lab. And not only that, in a, to me, a mind-bending experimental protocol, they were able to show that lucid dreamers could use these predetermined eye movements in their dreams. So for instance, looking extreme left to extreme right, left to right. And these signals that you're doing in your dream with your eyes can actually get picked up by electrodes that are placed above and below your real physical eyes as you sleep in the lab. So, and can detect these left, right movements that are going on under your closed eyelids. So you literally have someone who's asleep in your lab, who is in REM sleep, the sleep stage most strongly associated with vivid dreaming. And from inside their dream, they're telling you, oh yeah, I know I'm at a lab. I know I have an experiment I was asked to carry out. And by the way, here's a left, right eye signal to tell you that I'm lucid. And now I'm going to give you a second signal to tell you that I'm going to start the task that you asked me to do in my dream, like counting to 10 or singing a song or trying to do squats. And then when the person has finished that activity in their dream, they will do a third signal. And this is really powerful because it allows researchers to know exactly where in their various psychophysiological recordings they have of the sleeping subject, where to look for corresponding patterns in brain or bodily activity with respect to the activity that was done. So that you know that between signal 2 and 3, for instance, the person was counting or clenching their fists, and between signals 3 and 4, doing something else. And so you can really look at what was going on in the body and the brain at the exact time they were doing these things. So this showed that lucid dreaming was a real, that they happened in REM sleep, and also opened up this really fascinating venue where dreamers can communicate with experimenters from within their dream.
Hmm. Robert, you mention in the book, both of you do, that you both of your longstanding fascination with what you describe as the universal experience of dreaming, that you say is at the heart of your decision to write the book. Explain that for us.
But I think the reason Tony and I wanted to write it most of all is because we love the concept. I mean, everybody dreams and everybody is fascinated by their dreams. And everybody wants to understand better what's happening when they dream. And us no less than everybody else. I mean, I have this policy of my own that when I go to parties, I don't mention that I study dreams, because if I do, the next 8 words, right, out of the person, oh, I had the most amazing dream last night. Yeah. And then they go and they tell me this totally boring and uninteresting. And
right, and they want you to interpret
and
it.
And then they
right?
ask you, I mean, what does it mean, right? And I always give the same answer. I look at them very seriously and I say, you are one sick cookie. And then as their facial expression starts to crumble, I laugh and I say, I have no idea. I have no idea what it means. And I'm not even sure it means anything. But we all want that question answered. Why did I dream that? What does it mean? And so we decided to answer that question.
We have to talk about the influence of some of the early sort of pioneers in this research. But everyone always thinks about Freud first, seems like. And you do mention how Freud's influence on our beliefs about dreaming cannot be, as you say, overemphasized. But it also turns out, I didn't realize this, but you mentioned this in the book, Freud's ideas weren't all that novel or even original. That surprised me. Talk a little bit about Sigmund Freud and his ideas about dreams. Let's talk about that. Robert?
No, I'm going to Tony. That's Tony's specialty.
Oh, okay, great.
All right. Well, the thing with Freud's work, and indeed we can't overemphasize its importance, but his interpretation of dreams was his first major work and the cornerstone of the whole psychoanalytic movement. And so it became very difficult to point out or attack all the things that were wrong with the ideas or presumptions that he put forth in the interpretation of dreams without this snowballing into attack into the whole psychoanalytic enterprise or school of thought. But indeed, what we know now is that he didn't give really credit where credit was due, including for his own ideas. So, and some he only acknowledged, but about 10 to 15 years after the first edition of The Interpretation of Dreams was published. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when people think about, oh, well, dreams contains symbols and mostly symbols related to, sexual organs. Well, it turns out that those ideas that were put forth in really these psychologically sophisticated discussions of the nature of dream symbols were published 40 years before Freud by someone called Carl Scherner. And so he's the one who first wrote that the penis, for instance, could be symbolized by a tobacco pipe or a knife or a clarinet. That wasn't Freud. Or the female sex organ could be represented by a narrow path surrounded by houses. And so there's a lot of ideas, including about, well, dreams are reflection of the unconscious or dreams are related to wishes that really had been around before Freud use them or weave them into his model of the interpretation of dreams. Now, Bob mentioned that in the 50 or so years before The Interpretation of Dreams was published, there was a lot of really fascinating work being done on the nature and possible function of dreams. And these are people who were really trying to conduct what we would call dream science. They were trying to see, what are different sensory modalities? Can we use smells or kinds of conditioning to try to influence people's dreams?
I want to jump in there, and so you highlight this particular story because you do tell the story of these early pioneers, and you're talking about in that the idea of smells. The French researcher Hervé de Saint-Denis, you write about, and he is so fat. He wrote about, you say, he wrote this book that explored how external stimuli affected dreams. And what I think is so great about him and his work is that he experimented on himself. So when you're talking about this, tell about his perfume test, because I loved this part of the book.
So already someone before him had tried to use Alfred Murray. So already back in 1861 in a book called Sleep and Dreams, he showed that it was possible to use external stimuli. So whether it's smells or flashing lights presented through his closed eyelids as he was sleeping, or a source of heat, sort of like a match that was lit, smells from the match lighting and so on, and how this impacted his dream. So he was interested in how physiological stimuli from the external world could influence dreams. And he showed this really well. But Saint-Denis took this further. When he would travel to different areas of France, he would always buy a perfume in that area, in that village or town or region he was visiting. And he would smell that perfume daily wherever he went in that region. And he did this for every different area of France that he visited. So he had a series of perfumes, each one associated uniquely with a specific town or area that he had visited. Then what he would have an assistant do was, while he was asleep and not knowing on what night or which perfume would be used. His assistant would take a few drops of one of the perfumes randomly and put them on a handkerchief and hold it under Hervé Saint Denis' nose while he slept. And what he found was that just being exposed to that smell would result in him dreaming of the area or the town that had been associated with that smell. And then he did things even more complex where more than one smell would be combined. And that gave rise to dreams where there was elements from both villages that would sort of come and meld together in his dream. And he also did this with other sensory modalities. So when Saint-Denis would go to what today we would call a party, and he'd dance with this beautiful woman, but he'd ask the orchestra to play a particular song or waltz while he was with this woman, and a different one, a different song, when he danced with a second woman. And the idea here was later on, again, much like with the perfumes, when he was asleep, his assistant would on a, what today we would call a very primitive record player, would play one of the two songs with the intention of inducing a dream where he would dream of the woman associated with the song. So these are all really interesting experiments he was conducting on himself to also try to better understand how does the mind or the brain go about finding the images that get presented in our dreams and how are they associated to different elements from our waking lives. And so, again, these are just a few examples among many that we present early on in the book of how dreams were being studied in a very different way, also evaluating, well, what kind of mental faculties are intact in our dreams and which ones are altered and in what way? What are the limits of logical thinking or imagination that we can execute while we are asleep and dreaming? So these are the kinds of questions some of these people were exploring, and it's exactly the kinds of questions that people tried to answer when the modern era of dream research, so starting in the late 50s and 1960s, started after the discovery of REM sleep, the sleep stage most strongly associated with vivid dreaming. But between these works that occurred between about 1850 and 1900 and this other wave of research that began in the 1960s, we had a long period where really the dominant idea was, what does this dream mean? And so we're really far from trying to understand what is necessarily their function, what is the role of sleep or the dreaming brain in these processes. We're more into what Bob mentioned before and the reason he doesn't tell people at parties that he studies dreams. It's sort of like, well, here's this dream I had yesterday. What does it mean? And just to make one thing clear, we don't suggest that dreams don't have necessarily a psychological meaning, but they don't have a unique, singular meaning. And the way we like to present this is, for us, dreams are very similar to works of art. And when you observe a work of art, well, it doesn't have one meaning. It means this. It means different things to different people, including the artists who have created these works of art.
And they hate the question. They hate the question. Yeah. If you take a musician and you ask them, so that song you wrote, what is that song about? What does that mean? I mean, you get very nasty responses from them because they don't think that's a meaningful question. You take someone who wrote a book, you know, and you know, a novel, and you say, well, what does it mean? And the answer is, on some level, it doesn't mean anything in specific. It is a stimulus, if you will, for your mind and your brain to do with as you please. And you will make the associations that make sense to you, and it will take on meaning for you that might be very different than what that book or that song means for someone else. And that's equally true for our dreams. First of all, they weren't constructed with the intent of communicating a meaning to us. Their purpose is merely to look for possible connections to other things in our brains and look and see if those associations look useful. Not if they explain anything, but, you know, it's like when you say to someone, well, you know, you might think about this. Not telling them what to do with that thought, but think about it and see what you come up with. Dreams are like a good teacher. They're not trying to get you to memorize something. They're not just trying to teach you facts that you can memorize and spit back on the exam. They're trying really to get you to be able to think about things in a larger context and put things together, what we call critical thinking. That's what dreaming is about.
It's Robert Stickgold. He's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Antonio Sadra is a professor of psychology at the University of Montreal. Their book is When Brains Dream, Exploring the Science and Mystery of Sleep. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Cars are an important part of everyday life until they break down and just take up space in the driveway. If you can't drive an old vehicle, why not donate it to support KUER? We'll come pick it up for free, and you could receive a tax deduction. It's an easy and convenient way to support the informative, engaging public radio programs that you trust. Learn more about making a vehicle donation at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about dreams with the researchers Robert Stickgold and Antonio Sadra. They have a new book where they explore why we dream, that is, what our brain is trying to accomplish by giving us one. And they told us when our brains construct a dream, it's creating this amazing virtual world to see how we'll react and to teach us. Teach us to work out a proper response, a more healthy reaction. The book is called When Brains Dream. What is a dream exactly? Because you say in the book, when our brains construct a dream, it's creating what you describe as this amazingly comprehensive virtual world within our mind. And it's an illusory experience, a sensory experience. But what is it? What is a dream?
It's an experience. I mean, it's a period of time in which you get to walk in an illusory world. A dream is a construction of brain activity, which raises itself to the level of conscious awareness. And so we experience it. And you can think of the dream as that experience, the phenomenological event of experiencing these sensations and these emotions and these thoughts, or you could think of it as the brain activity that generates those hallucinations, those feelings, those thoughts, or you can think of it probably more accurate as both of those together. So normally we have the sensations coming from the outside world, mm-hmm. and then we create a representation of that in our brain. So when you hear me talking, what you're aware of actually is brain activity in your own brain that is creating a simulacrum of my speaking. But you perceive it as if you were actually perceiving me speaking. So it's no different. It's just that the source of that brain representation that you are consciously aware of is an internal generator as opposed to an external generator.
It made me wonder about movement. I mean, one of the things you mentioned, with Tony's experience with his nephew, you're seeing things, but you're not using your eyes. You're hearing things, but you're not using your ear. So it's confusing for us. And the same with movement. It's all illusory. Seems like we are moving, but we're not really contracting our muscles. Though I have to say, when I see my dog dreaming, it seems like he is running somewhere or trying to, even though he's laying there on the ground. But talk a little bit about the illusory, because you say that the brain in a dream state can even give quadriplegics an illusory orgasm. So what's the interplay between the physical process and the stuff going on in our brain, if that makes sense?
Yeah. Well, first of all, that last example you gave with the quadriplegics clearly illustrates the most important organ in the body is the brain.
Yeah.
Contrary to what some people might claim.
Right.
To think that your brain creates a setting, populates them with creatures or characters and mm-hmm. buildings and temperatures and sometimes wind and things of that nature. And then that you can move through this. And this is really complicated because as you're moving through your virtual world, well, all the perceptions around you are changing. You know, if you're walking away from a crowd, the crowd is getting smaller as you move away. Or if you're walking towards your girlfriend or family member, well, they get bigger. If a dog barks, well, they're, you know, it's more convincing if the sound that reaches your dreaming ear is well matched to the movement of the dog's, you know, mouth as it's barking. So there's all these incredible computations going on to give these multi-sensory experiences, including motions and motions for things that we've rarely experienced, if ever, during wakefulness, like flying dreams, where you feel yourself soaring, but you also can feel the wind resistance, or even, you know, being in these devices or automobiles accelerating, and you really seem to feel the gravity pulling on you or the centrifugal forces. And so the brain really does an astonishingly convincing job to make you think that what is happening is actually real. And it's not just in how exquisitely detailed sometimes the environment of our dreams are rendered, but also the various sensations that we have. But it's not necessarily that surprising, because before, when Bob was mentioning how what your brain does, among other things, really it's interpreting what all these electrical signals that are, when we are awake, that are coming in through our ears or our nose, what they mean, how they map onto what's in the outside world. In dreams, the brain auto-generates these signals, and in a really, again, fantastic but often overlooked dynamic, creates you, your body, you as the dreamer, and the environment in which you find yourself. And you're in this constant dynamic interplay with the dream world, with the people around you. And even though your brain is creating this, one absolutely, at least to me, fascinating aspect of dreams is that you, the dreamer, usually have no idea what's going to happen next, even though your brain sure does. It's creating the dream. So when you meet a dream character and you say, oh, why are you so upset today? Because the person is yelling at you or whatever, or your boss in the dream is not pleased with your work, or your partner is jealous about an email or a phone message they caught, you ask them a question. You really have no idea how they will respond. What are they going to say? But you are the one, or your brain is the one, that will be producing these responses. So in a very real sense, you are continually surprising yourself.
So, but why is that? What is the brain doing with all of this? I'm not sure if it's the right word, but it's like the brain is testing you or observing how we react and how our responses influence the people and events in our dreams. It's like our brain is doing research on how we're responding to almost teach us something.
That's exactly
referring to something, Robert.
That's exactly right.
And if Tony and I have come up with this model of dreaming we call Next Up. It's an abbreviation for network exploration to understand possibilities. And the basic idea and what we think is going on is almost exactly what you said. The brain is taking you and it is working off of some concern, some unfinished business from your day. It can be something big like your boss offered you a promotion but without a pay raise, and what are you going to do about that? Or you get a job offer somewhere else. Or it could be something really small like you're walking down the street and you see someone who looks sad and you wonder why they feel so sad. But you end up going to bed with these questions left in your mind. And if you think about the process of going to sleep, if you think about that period where you lie in bed before you fall asleep, if you're not someone who falls asleep really quickly, you'll notice that all these thoughts go fleeting through your mind as you're falling asleep, all about the things that happened in the day, things that you didn't finish, things you have to do tomorrow, things people said that you're not sure you understand. It's as if, and it probably is in fact, that your brain is going through your day and identifying events and newly formed memories that include unanswered questions, that can have concerns that still have to be resolved. And then when you go to sleep, your brain does this very clever thing. It takes one of those concerns, or maybe two or three, and it looks for memories you have that are usually weakly associated, and not the strong associations that you would have thought of during the day, but those sort of distant associations that you would never think of during the day. And it takes those distant, weak associations, and it creates a story for you. And it plops you down into the middle of it, and it watches how you respond. And if it creates this narrative, this story, with this weak association, and it generates an emotional response in you, you the dreamer, in the dream, then the brain does a calculation. It says, okay, this new association that I found to this event in the day, that's stirring something up. That has some meaning. I'm going to take that association and I'm going to strengthen it, so it becomes a stronger association, so that when I am awake tomorrow, or when I'm awake a month or a year from now, if I think of this concern again, this association is likely to pop into my mind as something that might be useful. And it doesn't matter whether you remember the dream, because all the work is done right there. Your brain says, boom, emotional response to this association, strengthen that association, make it available for you to use later. It's the equivalent of being at a therapist and the therapist saying, that sounds important. Tell me more about that.
So dreams aren't just replaying events from our life the way that we remember them when we're awake. It, as you say, it tells us these stories. So in that sense, it's kind of an analogy or a metaphor. It's a semantic sort of thing.
That's right. So first of all, I have a study that we published 20 years ago now where we showed that, in fact, people don't replay actual memories in their dreams. PTSD is an exception to that. But with that exception out, when we say I dreamt about X, or I had this thing happen in my dream, and oh, that was because this happened yesterday, it's never an actual replay of that memory. It's always a story about it. And it's a story because that's the only way our brains have evolved to solve certain types of problems. If you want to figure out how you're going to get home in time for dinner tonight because you're leaving work 15 minutes late, you run that narrative in your mind. You picture yourself getting in the car and maybe going this other way that you don't like to go because it's a hassle, but it's a little bit faster. And you imagine calling your partner and saying, I'm going to be a few minutes late. And you imagine their reaction and what are you going to say to them. You do the same thing. The only way we can plan for the future is to imagine it as a story in our minds. And for most things, we do that while we're awake. But for the really tricky ones, the ones where we don't have an answer, the ones where we say, I have to sleep on that one.
Yeah.
We go into an altered brain state while we're sleeping that cuts off access to the actual memory. It changes the neuromodulation of our brain in a way that those weak associations are more likely to appear important. And that's why people keep asking me about these stupid dreams, because their brain says, this is probably important. And so it gives us a second chance and a second way to be more creative in trying to solve these problems that we could try to think out during the day as well.
Yeah, it seems like creativity is an important part of that, because one of the things you both talked about is that these dreams, they're not offering definitive solutions. They get us to what you've described as the solution space.
Right. It's the sort of things that when someone says it to you, your response is, oh, wow, I never thought of that. Oh, yeah. Oh, that makes sense. That's what your brain is trying to do while you're dreaming. It's trying to be that person who throws at you a curveball, who I sometimes describe dreaming as being like a venture capitalist. A venture capitalist doesn't need everything to work out perfectly. It's looking for the one investment in 10 that has a huge payoff. And your brain is sort of doing that. It's bringing up these weak associations and saying, what about this? What about that?
But can we control it? Like if we want to somehow make that process more useful to us or more efficient to us, because it seems like completely unconscious in some ways. If it doesn't matter that we recall this process, that somehow it'll come back to us at some point, this association, even though it may be a weak association, it seems like it would be hard to kind of manipulate it or control it or make it even more useful for us. Or am I wrong about that?
You've tried it. Everybody has tried it. Everybody has thought, oh, I would love to dream about. And what they actually most would love to dream about, it turns out, is flying. But it's right. Really, really hard to control the content of your dreams. And in fact, back in the 1960s and 1970s, Freudian dreams theorists tried to do that, to manipulate the content of dreams. And so they would show college students these movies that were training films from the army on how to do field amputations. And there are these horrific movies of actual field amputations. And the idea was this would be so emotional that the kids would obviously dream about it. But the conclusion was nobody dreamt about it. The closest they got is someone who dreamt that they lost their wallet. And the Freudians said, well, that's losing a part of yourself. The first really successful experiments at dream manipulation, if I do say so, were done by myself, and they were done using the computer game Tetris. And they were done not collecting dreams after we awaken people from REM sleep, but when we awaken them just a minute or two after they fall asleep. Because it turns out, and most of us have had these experiences, if you've done something like been learning a new computer game, very often you'll go to bed at night and you'll close your eyes, and you'll see it playing out in front of your eyes. Or students who are taking organic chemistry tell us that as they're falling asleep, they see these molecules rotating in space, showing them all the different views of the molecule. And that process continues into the first few minutes after we fall asleep. So again, the trick to manipulating dream content is to convince the brain that you have an unfinished problem that you're going to need a solution for tomorrow. And then your brain will try to work on that while you're sleeping. Just talking about general sleep and memory benefits, we know that if you train a subject on some task before they go to sleep and tell them tomorrow morning we're going to give you a different task altogether, they won't get any better the next morning. But if we train them on that same task, and after they're done learning it, we say, by the way, we're going to test you on it tomorrow, then they'll actually improve overnight. And in some cases, Aaron Walmsley has shown they'll actually dream about it. So it's that expectation that the brain needs to work on it. It's unfinished business that gets it into your dream. Not just the fact that you want to sleep with this movie star, or you want to be able to fly, or you want to go to the moon. That's not enough to get it in.
In the book, you lay out some of the key challenges ahead in dream research. So I wanted to ask you about that. You say we still don't really understand how the brain picks those memories to use when it's constructing a dream. We don't know how the brain constructs like the face of a stranger, or how it gives strangers personalities and behaviors. Talk a little bit about what we still are hoping to learn about dreams.
Maybe I would just start by saying many of the things about dreams that we still know very little to nothing about also applies to waking consciousness. You mentioned we don't know where how the brain picks certain, you know, images or themes, and you know, and how it weaves them together into our dream experiences. But if, and this is an example that Bob likes to give, but if we are to ask you, think of something that happened to you yesterday, okay? Maybe something that was emotionally salient for you. Do you have something in mind right now?
I was in the dentist chair for 4 hours yesterday. It seemed pretty emotionally salient. I hated the experience. But yes, yes, I have something in mind.
All right, good. Well, the thing is, no one has any idea how you did that. No one knows how you went through the different experiences yesterday and how you went about selecting that
or how you even found memory ones that were from yesterday as opposed to a week ago. Right?
Huh.
Go on, Tony.
Don't know that.
No.
Yeah.
No, we don't. And so again, there's many parallels to make about questions we have about wakefulness, consciousness, our cognitive abilities, how we go about thinking, imagining, predicting things and during wakefulness. And many of these core questions apply also, of course, to dreams, which in many respects we can consider as an altered state of consciousness. So there's definitely many challenges. And even when people sometimes ask us, do you think we're on the cusp of being able to record people's dreams? I mean, really like video record them. And I like to answer saying, well, until we can record people's waking imaginations or right. fantasies, I really don't see how we'll be able to really record in any detail or with any fine-grained resolution the multi-sensory experiences that people have while they are asleep.
But you do also, though, ask some of the what could be troubling questions about the future. Recording our dreams is one of them. And, you know, who has access to that recording if you could ever make it somehow? And, you know, and whether or not that recording could make it to some, you know, maker of tortilla chips and that's now on your Instagram feed. You do explore that a little bit, but you also talk about that the reach of technology, that, you know, what if there was technology where you could alter your dreams or change what your brain is doing in dreams and tailor it? You know, would that be a good thing? And what if you blocked something your brain was trying to accomplish in a dream? You know, that process of learning and understanding that you were talking about before. So there could be some really disturbing things that could happen if we try and manipulate this too much, it seems.
Absolutely. And there's certainly a huge appetite for those kinds of technologies. And many companies have been and continue to actively work on them. But again, when you take a step back and you think about the potential consequences of this, or again, when people say, oh, if we had a tech that could record outlines of your dreams, would you be interested? Most people would go, yeah, until we ask them, well, okay, and who has access to this? Well, I said, well, just me. Well, what about the makers of the device whose proprietary algorithm gave you access to this? They'll want to have access, and you don't have access to their algorithm. And then they start fidgeting. And then, well, what if maybe things that you dreamt about maybe gave a clue that you were involved in some illicit activity because these themes of consuming drugs come up a lot in your dreams or being unfaithful to your partner.
So, Tony, it's interesting. As I'm listening to you for the first time, I'm thinking, well, when you say if you can record your dreams, what you're really talking about doing is wanting to record the results of these searches your brain is making for to find these weak associations. And who else is already recording the results of the searches our brains are trying to make?
I
mean,
right.
Google's got them all.
Yeah.
Every search we make. And sometimes, you know, you do a search for something and then you go to your public library website and up comes an ad for one of the sites that came up when you Googled this totally unrelated thing and say, oh my God, they're getting feeds from Google now. And then you look, and then you look at the FBI, which is currently in the US going after the people involved in the assault on the Capitol in Washington. And they're going and looking at people's search history.
I have to say, there's another one I wanted to ask you about in terms of like the troubling possibilities of the future. And you ask this compelling question in the book, would there be a risk of some kind of dream addiction? Because what if we had the technology where we could induce a dream? We could go into a dream state, and we could, in that state, we could create this image of ourselves as, you know, the perfect physical specimen. We have power, great sex, amazing wealth. What would that do to us when we inevitably had to wake up? We would always want to be in that dream state, it seems.
I think there would be a market for drugs that allow you to remain asleep and your body functioning while you avoid waking reality for as long as you can. And in all seriousness, when you look at, without necessarily talking about addictions, but the number of hours that some gamers will spend immersed in their virtual gaming worlds and the appeal of all kinds of video games and immersive technologies and VR, you know, dreams would just, you know, it would be like Formula One having to race against, you know, a horse that needs to be shot because it has a broken leg. I mean, there'd be no competition in terms of the realism and immersive experience that dreams have to offer. So I think that the potential danger of people wanting to remain there is to be expected. And I'm reminded, for those listeners maybe who have read the novel, of Ready Player One, where people really have these parallel lives that they are living through these interfaces that gives them access to an alternate world, which is much less harsh and brutal than their waking realities.
Let's finally come back to this idea, gentlemen, that I'm sure you hear about all the time, this idea that all of this scientific research is just going to ruin what is so great about dreams, that is the mystery of them and the wonder of them. You were referring to this a little bit earlier, but you say you hope that the book will put those concerns to rest. Say something about that, both of you, finally.
All the time that Tony and I have spent studying dreams, probably close to 50 person years together, has done nothing but made us more and more of dream junkies. Fascinated, excited, sucked into the mystery, the wonder, the excitement. I mean, it just makes it all the more amazing. I mean, did going to the moon make the moon less wonderful and less exciting and less of a source of wonder and amazement? No, it just pushed us a little bit further in that mystery. And you can't take away the mystery of the actual experience of dreaming. It's like saying to someone, oh, now that I understand how the primary visual cortex encodes sensory input coming from the retina, I can't appreciate paintings anymore. I can't appreciate a person's face anymore because I know it's just a representation in my brain. No, it just makes it more amazing and more wonderful that it can happen.
Yeah, I don't think I can say it better, Bob, but I will add this. I think when we started off, we mentioned how an unlikely and unusual concept dreams are. And part of the science of dreams is showing exactly how wondrous are these creations of our brain. And so even by detailing things about how the brain searches for these weak associations, or how we surprise ourselves literally every time we interact with our dreams or the characters that inhabit them, you know, science is actually pointing out new angles and ways in which to view dreams as really something that's absolutely fantastic. And I agree with Bob. I mean, the more, to me anyways, the more we learn about the science of dreams and its underlying neurobiological processes and what cognitive functions are active or less active in them, really makes the whole experience of dreaming all the more fantastic to consider and to want to continue to study.
Or you can think of the science of dreaming as like an art appreciation course. If you take an art appreciation course, you don't say, oh, that's what they were doing, and appreciate it less. You appreciate it more.
Robert Stickgold and Antonio Sadra, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Robert Stickgold is a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. Antonio Sadra is a professor of psychology at the University of Montreal. They're co-authors of the book When Brains Dream, Exploring the Science and Mystery of Sleep. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.